This afternoon, I want to take a very basic look at one of the traditions that underlie modern libertarianism, namely 19th century individualist anarchism in America. Before doing so, however, I want to define what I mean by modern libertarianism, and that is the body of political thought that emerged from and continues to develop through the synthesis of the best from several schools of thought. The synthesis was accomplished by Murray Rothbard when he took the radical anti-statism of individualist anarchists and wed it with first Austrian economics, second the foreign policy of the old right, that is isolationism, and the natural law tradition. Of these threads that were woven together, the least understood and the least appreciated is individualist anarchism. And I think one reason for this oversight, if you want to call it that, is because at first glance, individualist anarchism doesn't seem to share a key characteristic that unites the other traditions. That is, it doesn't seem to argue for the free market. If there is any validity to a distinction between economic liberties and civil liberties, and I don't believe there is, but if there is any distinction, individualist anarchism seems to fall into the category of civil liberties, which sometimes becomes an afterthought attached to free market analysis. In other words, it doesn't seem to be a good fit with other building blocks of libertarianism, for the simple reason that individualist anarchists, like most 19th century radicals, embraced a labor theory of value and rejected capitalism. There's no question about that. By this, I don't mean merely that they rejected the alliance between big government and business. They rejected actual capitalism. They rejected the making of profit off capital through such practices as charging interest on loans. This would seem to make individualist anarchism, as I said, a bad fit. And yet, one of the points I want to drive home today, in a very general and basic manner, is that individualist anarchism was profoundly free market, and that its anti-capitalism is not an ideological barrier, as it's usually portrayed to be. Before moving on to that point, however, I want to expand on just one reason, because I think it's very important to understand why it's necessary to redeem this tradition. One reason why modern libertarianism shouldn't stumble over the anti-capitalism of figures like Lysander Spooner, Benjamin Tucker, Josiah Warren, and thus lose the value that they offer. My view of history, the analytical approach I use in order to make sense of events, is ideological. Rothbard viewed history as an ongoing struggle between liberty and power, between what Rand would have termed the individual and the collective. And these days, it's not popular to believe in an ideological approach to anything, it seems. For example, people are said not to vote for right or wrong, but through utilitarian concerns. And I've always been baffled by this, because it seems that if you just look around the world, this approach is just totally disproved. For example, two of the most powerful forces that have defined everyone in this room are both profoundly and at their root ideological, Christianity and Marxism. And from these two examples alone, it would seem to me that it's impossible to deny the power of ideology as a force in human history. But in viewing history as a struggle, an ongoing and never really resolved struggle between ideologies, a lamentable thing has become clear to me, and that is the left is much, much better at claiming history, at mining the rich troves of history, than we are, much better. If you look through standard textbooks or do a brute numerical count on historical treatments or biographies, for example, you reach the inescapable conclusion that socialism was the working class movement that championed the average man on the street against government and big business. And socialism has reaped great benefits, including the credibility it now enjoys, because of this image. And the problem is the image is absolutely, totally false. 19th century libertarians have as much claim to be champions of the average man, and a far better claim, in fact, in most cases, than socialists do. And I want you to consider only one figure, Moses Harman, one of my very favorite figures in libertarian history. It is delivered wisdom that the socialistic Margaret Sanger was the heroine responsible for birth control and freedom of birth control in America. And birth control in 19th century America was a working class issue for various reasons. Yet Sanger herself acknowledged that her work would not have been possible, she could not have even existed, without the decades of groundwork that had been laid by Moses Harman. The socialist anarchist Emma Goldman, also credited as being a pioneer of Sanger, also paid homage to Moses Harman, acknowledging that she could not have existed without in terms of birth control without Harman there. Moreover, Harman's reputation was not confined to America. He was very influential in his time. In 1907, when the playwright George Bernard Shaw was questioned about why he never visited America, he replied, and was quoted in the periodical London Opinion, quote, "The reason I do not go to America is that I am afraid of being arrested and imprisoned like Mr. Moses Harman," end quote. Shaw went on to explain that the harsh prison sentence imposed upon a man of Harman's advanced age, he was at last imprisoned at the age of 75 when he broke rocks at Joliet, and which basically led to his death. That the prison, that the death sentence imposed on him for, was for expressing the same views that Shaw had aired in his play Man and Superman. These views were a woman's body, a woman's right, self-ownership. Every human being has a right to possess their own body and their own persons and to use it in any peaceful manner they see fit. In short, he was explicitly libertarian. Now, if you contrast the treatment of Sanger as an historical figure with that of Harman, you'll get a sense of why I believe the socialists are much better at mining history to their advantage. There are dozens of books about Sanger. Her own work is still available. New York University has what is called the Margaret Sanger Papers Project. She's in halls of fame. Buildings are named after. She herself was named by Time magazine as one of the top 100 people of the century. Meanwhile, there is not so much as one biography of Moses Harman. As a result, it is the left and not libertarians who've acquired the invaluable cachet as being seen as the ideology that stands for the freedom of working people. Now, I think the opposite is true. I've read the history. I know the opposite is true. And I think one of the saddest aspects of modern libertarianism is that it has surrendered or ignored its own history and thus surrendered its rightful claim to being the true radicals of working people, who people are out there trying to make a living against the coalition of government and business, against state capitalism. Now, this is a claim that if history were not being so ignored, would go a long way toward dispelling an accusation commonly hurled at libertarianism, namely that it represents only the interests of business. There's no way to take an honest look at history in the 19th century and make that accusation. So, having laid the groundwork of why I believe individualist anarchism is absolutely essential to be infused into the modern tradition, what is the tradition of 19th century anarchism, individualist anarchism? The fundamental principle upon which it is based is what the abolitionist, the radical anti-slavery advocate, William Lloyd Garrison, circa 1830, called self-ownership. Self-ownership refers to the moral jurisdiction that every human being, simply by being human, has over his or her own body. Garrison argued that all secondary characteristics, such as race and gender, were absolutely irrelevant to the rights and duties that accrued to every human being as a result of the primary characteristic of a shared humanity. Now, I begin with Garrison because when you mention libertarianism around 1830s, he's the figure most people have heard of, and the figure to whom individualist anarchism is most often traced. I think that's a mistake. I think the far more appropriate fountainhead for the tradition is Josiah Warren, a contemporary whom the historian James J. Martin believes was the first person to adopt the label of anarchist. And I won't get into why I believe that right now, though the Q&A, I'd be happy to answer that. And could I have a glass of water, please? Josiah Warren began his radical career as a follower of the socialist Robert Owen. He was one of the first and original founders of the very famous New Haven, New Harmony community that began in 1826. And he saw firsthand what was wrong with the organizing principle of socialist communities. After decades and decades of discussion, these communities, utopian, had been discussed in England, they were discussed here. After many decades, they finally tried the experiment, and it was a disaster. It was a nightmare. After about a year and a half, it just totally deteriorated into nothing. And Warren was heartbroken. He was standing there watching his dreams fall apart. And he said, why? Why is this such a disaster? Well, he blamed the community's failure on its denial of personal property rights, on the demand for communal property that stifled all individual initiative. But the problem he perceived with community property went far beyond the economic motivation that who would take out the garbage. Warren wrote in his periodical letter, quote, "It seemed that the difference of opinion, tastes, and purposes increased just in proportion to the demand for conformity. It appeared that it was nature's own inherent law of diversity that had conquered us. Our united interests were directly at war with the individualities of persons and circumstances and the instinct of self-preservation. Communal property went against man's nature." So from Warren's disillusionment with collectivism, from his conviction that social harmony required radical individualism, thank you, the essential groundwork for an individualist anarchist society emerged. First and foremost, it was founded on the concept captured by the phrase sovereignty of the individual. And by this, Warren meant very much the same thing as Garrison had meant by self-ownership. In his book, Practical Details, Warren explained his meaning, quote, "Society must be so converted as to preserve the sovereignty of every individual inviolate. It must avoid all combinations and connections of persons and interests and all other arrangements which will not leave every individual at all times at liberty to dispose of his or her person and time and property in any manner which his or her feelings or judgment may dictate without involving the persons or interests of others," end quote. But Warren contributed much more than merely a rephrased statement of self-ownership. For example, and as just one example, because there are many, many you could carry through, Warren sketched out a fundamental approach to society that could be termed methodological individualism, a term usually associated with Ludwig von Mises. In Human Action, Mises described what he meant by the term, quote, "First we must realize that all actions are performed by individuals. If we scrutinize the meaning of the various actions performed by individuals, we must necessarily learn everything about the actions of the collective whole. For a social collective has no existence and reality outside the individual members' actions," end quote. Warren's approach to society echoed upward through decades into the next generation, where you find one of his main protégés, Benjamin Tucker, in 1888, dismissing Henry George's theory of community land ownership with words that sound Misesian. Quote, "That there is an entity known as the community, which is the rightful owner of all land, anarchists deny. I maintain the community is a non-entity, that it has no existence and is simply a combination of individuals having no prerogatives beyond those of the individuals themselves," end quote. So basically you have the seeds of approaches like methodological individualism back in Warren being carried through Tucker. Another contribution that Warren infused individuals to anarchism with was a passion for the practical. If one passion ruled Warren's life, it was to test social theories by translating them into reality. Because remember, he'd seen community just fall apart around him, a wonderful theory slain by an ugly fact. He needed to know if theories worked, not merely on paper and not merely in artificial communities, but he wanted them to work for the average man on the street. This passion for the practical, again, I said, was adopted by the generations that followed. To use Tucker again, he once commented, quote, in dismissing reform communities and utopian societies, "Reform communities will be recruited from the salt of the earth, and then their successes will not be taken as conclusive, because it will be said that their principles are applicable only among men and women well nigh perfect. It has no interest for me. I care nothing for any reform that cannot be effected right here in Boston among the everyday people whom I meet in the streets." And I should remind you, or perhaps tell you for the first time, that this quote came at the same moment as Edward Bellamy's hugely successful utopian novel, Looking Backward. The novel captured the popular vision with which radicals viewed the future. That is, if only their ideology could be adopted, if only their ideas could permeate society, then there would be a utopia. There'd be millennium. If you read women's suffrage, if you read socialist, if you read communitarians, Over and over again, if only they could dominate their ideology, lambs would lie down with lions, the workday would be 2 hours a day, and yet prosperity would reign, war would be ended. This was the norm. It was a constant theme of late 19th century radicalism. Excuse me. And it was the seed again of the new Soviet man and of the idea of man as a social construct that was championed by the Bolsheviks when they swept the 20th century Russia, which dominates in feminism today. So you have, with this remarkable statement coming out with this milieu around them, you have the individualist anarchists making several statements. They say, first of all, that individuals should not conform to society because, after all, there is no such thing as society. Only individuals exist. You also have them saying that whenever you explore a theory, it must be practical. It must work. We want to test it in reality. And they also say, making the additional claim, that they are not pursuing utopia. What they are pursuing is practical justice. Consider the words of Victor Yaros, who for a period co-edited Liberty. He wrote, quote, "The anarchists work not for a perfect social state, but for a perfect political system. A perfect social state is totally free of sin or crime or folly. A perfect political system is merely a system in which justice is observed, in which nothing is punished but crime, and no one coerced but the invader." End quote. It's a wonderful distinction. Now, the key to achieving this perfect political system lay in establishing institutions that promoted justice, which brings me to the subject of institutional analysis, the analysis of how institutions such as the state, the family, the free market function, their purpose, their rules, their actual impact. And here you have the next contribution of individualist anarchism, incredibly sophisticated, a very extensive institutional analysis that attempted to answer two questions. First, which institutions impede justice in a free society and how? Second, which institutions promote justice in a free society and how? It will surprise no one in the room that their answer to the first question, which institution impedes justice, was the state. The state is the institution that blocks justice, and it does so basically through the threat and use of force, or by persuading the people of its legitimacy, persuading them that it has a right to interfere in their lives, and thus doesn't have to use force to do so. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, or really any time, on the individualist anarchist analysis of the state as an institution, because to the extent that people here are familiar with individualist anarchism, the familiarity is on this point. To the extent that you've read one book, it's probably Spooner's No Treason. I want to move on to the second question, which institutions promote a free society, justice, and how? To this question, individualist anarchists made what to me is an astonishing response, like a bright flash of light in the radical landscape. They claimed that the institution necessary to secure justice, that the path to a perfect society already existed. It already operated and was already proven. Radicals to every side of them were saying that something new under the sun was necessary. We had to sweep away the state. We had to start from scratch. We had to have an anarcho-syndicalist view of the industrial relationship of man. They needed a brave new world. In this milieu, again, the individualist anarchists stood up and claimed, no, you don't need an entirely new blueprint. What you need is to get rid of the state and follow the existing institution that can bring freedom and justice, which was the free market. It already existed. And the mechanism through it, which the already existing institution necessary for freedom would operate and bring freedom, was the contract. Indeed, they believed so strongly in the power of contract that they called their vision society by contract. And they immediately started, because again, they're very practical, this was infused into the philosophy, they immediately started out to plan in very concrete detail how the free market could satisfy not only economic goals but social ones, such as justice. And, I mean, just pause for a second. This is so remarkable. The idea that the free market wasn't the absolute enemy of justice, but that it was the only vehicle that would bring justice. It not only brought prosperity, it brought peace and harmony. And they basically sketched out all the institutions, from private court systems to private defense agencies, not only internal police agencies, but foreign policy agencies, of how this could be accomplished. For example, they're in discussing a private court system, how that free market could arbitrate disputes. They went in their analysis went far beyond anything that is usually brought up in Spooner's trial by jury, which is considered to be the touchstone. Their discussion proceeded largely through economic analysis, through analysis of efficiency, rather than appeals to common law. For example, the sub-issue trial by jury, when it started, basically began with the idea of a man's right to try his own case in court, comes from Locke all the way through natural law, and then moved very immediately onto efficiency and economic issues. Nor did they confine themselves to discussion, to theory. Again, given their practical bent, you go out, you test your theories. If your theories don't work, there's something wrong with them. There's not something wrong with society or the nature of man. There is something wrong with your theory. They went out and tested their theories, and some very interesting experiments were conducted. Again, for example, they established private unemployment insurance cooperatives, whereby people paid into an agency X number of dollars, X percentage of their weekly earnings, and from which they would draw when they became unemployed for a certain period of time. So it's very difficult to stop talking about it. There's so many exciting things that they did that have just absolutely been ignored that I think were still the best experiments in terms of cooperative economics that I've ever seen. But having sketched the political contributions of individuals to anarchism, especially their locating social justice in the free market and in the use of contract, I want to move on to what is, I believe, the reason their contributions have been largely ignored. Namely, they championed the labor theory of value. There's no question about that. Earlier, I mentioned that the main theme underlying individuals to anarchism was sovereignty of the individual, to use Josiah Warren's term. Warren used another term to describe the second theme, the second principle of individuals to anarchism, which he thought derived directly from the first one, namely, cost is the limit of price. And this is where the labor theory of value begins to play a very prominent role in individuals to anarchism. To give you a sense of the specific approach to the labor theory of value adopted by Warren, I want to describe an experiment, again, always an experiment. Always test your social theories. They were the exact opposite of socialists. Don't wait for man to change. See how society basically accepts this theory, which is supposed to express the nature of man. I want to describe an experiment he conducted to test his solution to what was called the money monopoly. And by this, I mean the state's monopoly on the issuance of currency. Now, Warren's solution to state-controlled banking, which he believed was the cause of interest, was private currency, the right of every individual to issue his or her own private currency and have anyone who's willing to accept it use it as money. And he believed that the ability of individuals to issue private currency would destroy the perceived injustice of interest. In 1827, he opened a retail store that was called a time store, from which he issued what were called labor dollars. The store opened with something like $300 worth of groceries and dry goods. And by the way, I could have gone through every single person I've mentioned and said no biography, no background has been written on this. There's been nothing written on the time store. Anyone who's writing a dissertation or articles, it's pioneering work, and which I would be very glad to give you references on. He opened it with about $300 worth of groceries and dry goods that were offered at 7% markup from his cost in order to cover what he called contingent expenses. Where he made his profit was in selling his labor to customers by requiring them to pay for the time it took him to effect the transfer of goods. That is, the time that he basically spent initially purchasing the goods and then in selling them to people who came into his store. Because remember, this was before you would go into a store and things were prepackaged, pre-weighed, that there were prices weren't posted. You would take endless time bartering with the shopkeeper over the price of a pound of something. And in fact, one of the many inventions that Warren has been credited with, because he was an inventor, a very prominent man in his time, was he is said to be the first man to go and post prices on all of his goods in America so that when he walked into a store, you knew what you were buying and they were pre-weighed. Now, the customer would then come in, he would pay the price of the goods in hard currency, the currency of the time. And then he would compensate Warren for his time with a labor dollar that promised to give back to Warren an equal amount of the time in the buyer's occupation. If the buyer were a plumber, for example, the labor note committed him to render his services to Warren for X time units of plumbing work. Warren's goal here was to divorce the price of the goods from the compensation he received. In other words, to establish an economy in which his profit was based on the exchange of time and of labor. And to some degree, he succeeded. A thriving barter community arose and spread across outside the Radcliffe community, with regular people coming from 100 miles away to avail themselves of his low prices. What happened, of course, having succeeded to some degree, he closed the store because its entire purpose was to test the theory. Now, Warren was far from alone, even at that early date, in stressing private currency as a way to destroy the state. In 1843, which is roughly the same period, Lysander Spooner wrote a tract entitled Constitutional Law Relative to Credit, Currency, and Banking. He stated, quote, "To issue bills of credit, that is, promissory notes, is a natural right. The right of banking is as much a natural right as that of manufacturing cotton." Now, I won't spell out the differences, the specific differences between Warren's position and other versions of the Levy theory of value, but I will give you one difference, because one of the things that I really would like people to consider is whether or not these people were wrong. They were very interesting, and they were very intelligent, and they considered many of the issues that we bring up and question about labor theory of value ourselves. For example, one of the things that Warren was keenly aware of is that one man's labor is not equal to that of another man. Differences in education, skill, motivation, things like that naturally make one man more or less productive or valuable than another. How then could a free market, an equal exchange of one man's labor for another, function? Warren believed that sovereignty of the individual, which was always the default position when there was any kind of conflict, would address and solve the discrepancy through the evolution of a stock market, so to speak, in people's labor notes. The labor notes of an unproductive person would tend to be devalued, and he would find very few takers, on the basis of equal exchange, at least. In other words, individuals would use their own judgment to establish whose currency, which labor note, was worth accepting. Yet despite this kind of analysis, it can never be denied that individuals anarchists despised capitalism, despised capital, and thought that profit on capital was theft. In particular, they rejected it in three forms: interest on money, rent, and profit on exchange, all of which was called usury. If their main political goal can be stated, as I do believe it can be, as the abolition of the state, then it's no exaggeration to say that their main economic goal was the abolition of the money monopoly. And by this term, money monopoly, they referred to three different but interrelated forms of monopoly: banking, interest, and the issuance of currency. And I want to continue to focus on the issuance of currency. It's such a huge area, and I think this gives a very good sense of how they approached all other issues of usury. So, and another reason I want to focus on it, too, is that individualist anarchists like Benjamin Tucker believed that the issuance of private currency alone would destroy the state. It was crucial for several reasons. It was the key for several reasons. First, the state money monopoly was considered to be the means by which the average man was robbed of economic opportunities by the state and big business. Through the act of incorporating, bankers became immune from personal obligations. They acquired all the legal rights possible in terms of banking and avoided all the personal responsibility. This was not only a money-raking scheme that they ran, a scam that they ran on the public, it also denied credit to the working man. This was the main thing, the working man. It denied credit to working people by setting up prohibitive interest rates and unreasonable criteria for acquiring credit. The alternative banking system that Tucker embraced was what William B. Green, a contemporary of Warren and Garrison, called mutual money. Spooner referred to it in his tract, A New System of Paper Currency, as the invested dollar, and the French socialist anarchist Pierre Proudhon called it the bank of the people. By these terms, they all referred to a currency that ordinary people could issue themselves that would be secured by their own property. And for consistency, I'll just call it mutual money. Spooner described it as follows, quote, "The currency here proposed is not in the nature of a credit currency. It consists simply of bona fide certificates of stock, which the owners have the same right to sell that they have to sell any other stocks," end quote. To rephrase this, when Spooner spoke of an invested dollar of mutual money rather than a specie dollar, he meant currency that was backed by property of a fixed and permanent nature, such as a house, rather than the currency that was backed by gold or silver. He meant money that was based on a form of debt, a form of mortgage. And this mutual money was crucial, they believed, absolutely crucial to the empowerment of the worker. That was its whole purpose. In Poverty, Its Illegal Causes and Legal Cure, Spooner argued that men deserved the full fruits of their labor. And when you hear them called socialists, this is all it means. Libertarians bought into a certain view of socialism that men deserve the fruits of their labor. It was a very unpolitical term at that point in time. No appeal to government at all. He argued that they had deserved the full fruits of their labor, and the only way that this was likely to happen on a massive scale was to have each man become his own employer. And this required that each man have access to credit. Interestingly, though Spooner thought that interest rates would plunge if mutual money were established, he also objected to having artificially low rates of interest, indeed any standard interest rates at all, because if the working people who had no track record, for example, went to try to borrow money, they would naturally have to pay higher interest rates than the other person, and by sending low interest rates, you were in fact denying them the credit that they deserved, that it was their right to contract for. So it wasn't that they objected only to high rates, they objected to any rates. The key question here becomes, what if the issuer of private currency decides to charge interest on its use? Would that practice be prohibited? And the answer to this question is what separates advocates of the labor theory of value who are socialists from those who are libertarian. The socialists would say, no interest. It cannot be permitted to exist. It is theft. Individualist anarchists answer to a man and consistently. If a lender can find someone foolish enough, someone stupid enough, to voluntarily enter into such a contract, then the contracting parties must be left to their folly. The right of contract, what they called society by contract, was the higher law and always prevailed. In the terms that Josiah Warren used, if there ever was a conflict between sovereignty of the individual and cost is the limit of the price, sovereignty of the individual won hands out. Now, I know I'm racing through a lot of history here. One of the most tragic events in libertarian history was the destruction of Liberty magazine, of Tucker's offices, that led to the shutting down of Liberty in 1908. And one of the tragedies, I think, that is not sufficiently realized, there's many dimensions to it, was that a debate was beginning to reopen within the pages of Liberty between the American individualist anarchists and the British individualists, about whom even less is known than Tucker or Spooner. They basically live or die within obscure periodicals that very few people but me thread through the microfiche. Now, this would have been the fourth in a series of absolutely wonderful debates on economics that began in the beginning of the 1890s. The British individualists were the English counterparts to the Tucker Circle in America, and they were, generally speaking, far worse than political theory, by which I mean they weren't anarchists. That's my bias showing, I'm sure. But far better on economics. Among the best voices on economics was J. Greaves Fisher. In a debate that erupted in 1891, he pointed out that a mutual banking system already existed to some degree in England, that people there were free to issue promissory notes, for example, to deliver wheat or cotton, and yet the Bank of England seemed remarkably untouched by this. Moreover, he stated, quote, "Schemes to bring about the abolition of interest, especially when the authors promulgate this as a necessary consequence of free trading in banking, are pernicious. What is called free trade in banking actually means only unlimited liberty to create debt. It is the erroneous labeling of debt as money which begets most of the fallacies of currency faddists." End quote. In a second debate that occurred in 1893, Fisher neatly summed up the problem with the individual's anarchist position on economics. Quote, Mr. Bilgram, he was debating against a fellow named Hugo Bilgram. "Mr. Bilgram appears to take no notice of the argument that the rate of interest upon loans would still exist under a system of barter. Interest is the hire of commodities separated from their owner and entrusted to another person. The time of separation is a privation to one party and a benefit to the other." End quote. Fisher also argued in that same exchange, "For interest is a payment for risk." And as a result of this latter argument, another remarkable thing happened. Hugo Bilgram admitted that if interest were a payment for risk, then it was just. And this was an amazing admission, because Hugo Bilgram was one of the main anti-interest zealots. It essentially cut the moral ground out from any argument that opposed interest as a form of theft or usury. In short, during various debates near the end of liberty's lifespan, from 1890 onward, the American individualists moved toward the more Austrian view of economics, incrementally, year by year, whereas you could see the British individualists move closer and closer to the anarchistic point of view. Unfortunately, the exchanges were terminated with the fire that destroyed liberty, and no other form of exchange was ever established that I can find. In conclusion, and as a thought I'd like to leave you with, as far as I can see, whatever differences existed between the 19th century tradition in economics and now are differences without practical consequences. And again, with reference to the money monopoly, I'll leave it to Murray Rothbard to explain what I mean. Quote, "Suppose, for example, that I decided to print paper tickets called 2 Rothbards, 10 Rothbards, etc., and then tried to use these tickets as money. In the libertarian society, I would have a perfect right and freedom to do so. But the question is, who would take the tickets as money? Money depends on general acceptance, and general acceptance of a medium of exchange can begin only with commodities such as gold and silver." End quote. Rothbard summed up what he believed the impact of mutual money would have been. Quote, "The anarchist society would lead to much harder money than we would have now, without the state to create the conditions and coercions for continued inflation. Attempts at inflation and credit expansion could not have succeeded on the free market." End quote. As long as the default position of individuals to anarchism was the primacy of contracts, and it always was, then the free market would have inexorably established interest in hard currency. And that's what I mean by saying their economic theories were a difference with no practical significance. To restate what I mean, because it's the main point of my talk, first, individualist anarchists would have allowed such practices as interest to occur between consenting parties. They would have tried diligently to educate people as to the turpitude of interest. They would have set up parallel banking systems. They would have done anything they could peacefully to dissuade people from interest, but they would have allowed it. Second, without imposed restrictions, such practices would have occurred. They not only would have occurred, they would have flourished. And third, and as far more speculative matter on my point. I think the practical bent of individualist anarchists that made them test their social theories would have led them ultimately to question and probably to reject the labor theory of value when they were confronted with realities that disproved it, or when they were confronted by a few more indignant British individualists who just flat out argued them at every turn. So, what is the final word on individualist anarchism and its contributions? To quote Murray again, quote, by the mid-19th century, the libertarian individualist doctrine had reached the point where its most advanced thinkers, in their varying ways, had begun to realize that the state was incompatible with liberty or morality. But they went only so far as to assert the right of the lone individual to opt out of the state's network. Spooner and Tucker advanced libertarian individualism from a protest against existing evils to pointing the way to an ideal society toward which we can move. To rephrase this, individualist anarchism went beyond a personal ideology that merely protested the state. It provided a practical blueprint for social freedom that said what we need right now for social freedom already exists. It was a blueprint that, as far as I know, after a few decades of reading, I have never seen surpassed. Thank you.